questions. If you have questions about exams that aren't actually ours, I didn't bring those exams, so you'll have to let me listen carefully to the question.
You just decided to figure out what the questions
are. I did. So I didn't do it in the best possible fashion. I just grabbed something I had done before. So there are a handful of these questions on the so-called exam four that are not exactly phrased the way I would if it were for our class. In particular, question 13 says, describe the constituents of the universe at hadron era, lepton era, and radiation era. And those aren't terms that we used. But, you know, kind of similarly, you should be able to describe what the universe was like at different times.
Do you have answers up there again?
I didn't make a screencast of this. That would be helpful, is maybe. I'll try and put it on my to-do list.
I have a question about the organization of the test. So the stuff from exam 1, 2, and 3, about the information from those, are they going to be questions from these exams, or are they going to have new questions as well?
They will have new questions as well, but it'll probably be a minority. So right before this class, I was trying to reduce the number of true and false questions to 35, you know, because I had copied and pasted all of these nice questions from your exam. So I guess I haven't done a count, but my usual statement is that the final will resemble your old exams more than the previous year's exams resembled the exams you actually took. So there'll be huge similarities, but not identical. So that's the one about all these stars in the star cluster?
Yep.
And then you had to pick N from five or something like that. So this is all real data. So this deals with the star cluster NGC 6231. And we've got two stars that are very close together on the sky. So they're both Zeta SCO. One is Zeta 1 SCO and one Zeta 2 SCO. And the I hope it seems odd to you. The funny thing is that Zeta 2 SCO is brighter than Zeta 1 SCO, even though from its spectral type you would expect the reverse to be the case, right? I say that Zeta 1 SCO is one of the brightest stars in our galaxy. So right off the bat, you should be thinking that the only way it's possible for the brightest star in our galaxy to look dimmer than Zeta 2 SCO is it's more distant. So that is a kind of an immediate answer to D. Zeta 2 SCO can't be a member of the same star cluster as Zeta 1 SCO because they must be at radically different distances. So for the first question, how old is the star? So the only way we've really talked about measuring the age of stars is in the context of star clusters and kind of the overall speed of stars evolving. And a massive star like this, what is its spectral type? I thought I gave it. B11, that star has to have been born relatively recently. They die way too soon. So yes, this star had to be born probably in the last 100 million years. Whereas the Sun, of course, was born 4.6 billion years ago. How do we know the spectral type? Well, the the name is kind of in the name already, right? We determine the spectral type by taking a spectra. The set of absorption lines that are in the spectra tell you the spectral type. So that's how we know. We take spectras of these stars and match them up to the standards. What could cause the red color for what should be a blue star? Dust. I think just about everyone got that. Dust could make it dim, and it could make it red. We did D. So Zeta 2 SCO, we don't have any idea really how old it is, because it's not part of a cluster. It's a giant star. If it's a star that literally started out like the Sun, then it's further evolved. But it could have been a star that weighed a little bit less than the sun and then took a longer time to go through those stages, and so had to be born longer ago. So no, we can't say anything about Zeta Tusco. So distance modulus is a good way to get distances to objects. And we can look up in books what the absolute magnitude is of a B11 star, and we can then calculate the distance modulus. And we never converted distance modulus to numbers, but in fact the number comes out to be a little bit more than 5 kiloparsecs. And I state that that's not an accurate distance. Something went wrong. And of course what went wrong is that the distance modulus technique is assuming the only reason the star is dim is because it's distant. But we've pretty well concluded that the reason this star is dim is that there's dust in the way. So the star, if we could clear out the dust, the star really would be brighter, and we would calculate then a shorter distance. So it's probably shorter, closer than the 5,500 parsecs. So that's the moon problem. So I think as much as anything else, you know, my kind of lousy drawings make it moderately difficult to understand what's going on. So we have this circle, which is supposed to be the horizon, and this is north, this is west, this is east, and this is south. And this line is supposed to be the meridian, so of course the zenith is right up there. And in this first drawing, the sun is on the front surface. It's about setting. And in the other diagram, very similar setup, the sun is on the far surface. It's in the east, it's rising. And we're supposed to place all of these moons and draw what some of them would look like. So remember that the waxing phases, those are all things that you're going to see at sunset. Whereas the waning phases, those are the things you're going to see at sunrise. And of course, the other important fact is that the closer the moon is to the sun, the smaller the fraction of it that's white. So close is going to mean crescent. And more than 90 degrees, that's going to mean gibbous. And that applies to both of these drawings. So if we want a crescent waxing phase, which is B, we want to put it on the front surface close to the sun. If we want a waxing gibbous phase, then we want to put it on the far surface, more than 90 degrees away from the sun, and that's D. So on the far surface, that's where D is going to be. And similarly, for a waning crescent on the far surface, we're going to put it close to the sun, and that's A. And then for a waning gibbous, we're going to put it on the front surface, and that's going to be C. Okay, so the next thing we're supposed to do is to draw what some of these things look like. Do I specify or do you get to pick? Report directly. Oh, it's for E. Oh, so I'm supposed to draw what the waning crescent and the waxing crescent look like. Oh, okay. Well, it's according to this guy. So to us, of course, B is above the setting sun. And from the viewpoint we're looking at, it looks like it's to the right of that sun. But the other guy is going to be turning the other way, so those things are going to be reversed. So here's the sun, here's west, this moon is going to be up here someplace. And so the piece of the moon that is white is going to be pointing towards that sun. Now we have the same point of view as the guy here. So this moon in here, its white face is going to be pointing towards the sun. So here we have this rising sun, and here we have this moon over here, like that. So in the northern hemisphere, remember, white on the right that means we're talking about a waxing phase. Remember, waxing is just a fancy word for growing phase as opposed to a waning phase. Approximate date. So not on my diagrams, but in this diagram here, we actually see the diagram for the celestial equator and the diagram for the ecliptic. And we know that, of course, every day the whole celestial sphere rotates from west to east, but very slowly the sun is going the opposite way. So the sun is a little bit, maybe a month or so, away from an equinox. And it's an equinox where the sun was in the south and it's going towards the north. So we know that if the sun were here, it would be March 21. So I say, I don't know, February 21 or so. A little bit before March 21. And notice, as appropriate for the winter, that sun didn't rise exactly in the west, it rose south of west. Are we supposed to do the other one too? Oh, the date for each drawing. So the other one is right on an equinox, and it's an equinox where we're going from summer to winter, so that has to be exactly September 21. Same exam, 24. So 24 is this, you know, mark the spots on the solar system sort of problem. So we've got the sun. In this case, we've got the orbit of Venus and the orbit of Earth and the orbit of Mars. The Earth, of course, has a moon going around it, and there are little arrows that are reminding us that basically everything turns that way. So the data is that the moon was new yesterday. So a new moon would be in the same direction as the sun. So the moon should have moved on a little bit. So the new moon should be about there. A little bit beyond where it would be if it were new. Venus is an evening star. And again, if we were to blow up the little picture of the Earth that's there, the side that of the Earth that is facing the sun would be in brightness, and the Earth is spinning that way, so where we go from light to dark, that's evening. So the piece of the sky that we can see at evening is this piece. And Venus was just in conjunction with the sun, so Venus must be someplace like there. Mars will begin its retrograde motion in about 4 months. So retrograde motion is when the object is in opposition to the sun. So if Mars were moving retrograde now, it would be right there, seeming to move backwards as the Earth raced by it. But it's not going to happen now, it's going to happen in the future. So we know the Earth is moving faster than Mars, So we want to put Mars someplace about like that. Right, so that the Earth can catch up to it. Now, technically speaking, 4 months is a third of a year, so we really probably want to put Mars a little bit further along so that this retrograde motion can happen at about that location. I'm not sure I cared exactly where Mars was, but certainly needs to be well on from the current opposition. Okay. So who has noticed where Venus is now? It's the bright star that's there at sunset, so it's pretty much like that now. That's kind of surprising. Went through a full cycle in that period of time. More questions?
Can you go through number 31 on the first exam?
31 on the first exam. So this is where we are kind of dealing with the fact that the cycle of phases is, roughly speaking, 30 days, right? 29 and a half days. In contrast to the time it takes for the moon to go around the celestial sphere, which we don't need for this problem, but is about 27 and a third days, right? The difference between synoptic and sidereal. Okay, so the moon was new yesterday. Thanksgiving is 8 weeks and 1 day from today. Report the phase of the moon's phase on Thanksgiving. Well, so 8 weeks and 1 day, pretty much two complete cycles. If we want to get into more detail, right, we've got 29 and a half plus 29 and a half, which is going to give us 59 days. And that's going to be compared to 8 weeks, which is 57 days. So it's not quite two complete cycles. So if the sun is new today on Thanksgiving, it should be 2 days before new. So we're talking about a waning crescent. So where in the sky could you see a waning crescent? Waning phases are best seen at sunrise, so look in the east at sunrise. Should be fairly close to the sun. So these are contributions of a lot of famous dead people. So Copernicus is the guy who kind of wrote the book. Aristarchus had this idea way earlier, but Copernicus popularized this idea for medieval Europe. Tycho is the guy who did all those observations, 20 years of observations of the positions of the planets. He didn't really believe in heliocentrism himself. He believed this kind of funny Tychonic system is the name of it, where everything goes around the sun except the Earth. The sun goes around the Earth. Kepler's the guy who used a telescope to make these famous observations that showed, for example, that Venus at least had to be going around the sun because it showed phases. There isn't any problem with moons keeping up with these planets because Jupiter has moons and able to keep up just fine. And unlike what Aristotle said, things don't look perfect out in the heavens. Spots on the sun, mountains on the moon. I don't know what I prefaced all that with. I've just been talking about Galileo. Kepler is the guy who used Tycho's observations to show that the orbits couldn't be circles, they had to be ellipses with the sun at a focus. And also his other law being the Kepler's third law, where we have the semi-major axis cubed has to equal the period squared. So Galileo's all those telescopic observations. So phases of Venus, moons of Jupiter, imperfections.
Could you go over 34?
34. So draw an orbit of the picture of something going around the sun. So circular orbits have a small eccentricity, and squashed orbits, not with the sun at the center, but with the sun at a focus, those guys have larger eccentricities. Now there are lots of ways of drawing this, right? I could draw a circle like this, for example. It also has a small eccentricity. And depending upon what circles you've drawn, you have to decide which one of your orbits has a longer period. And in terms of period, what matters is the big diameter. So this guy has the smallest big diameter, this guy has the next smallest big diameter, and this guy has the biggest big diameter. So this is the fastest, the shortest period, this has the next shortest period, and this one has the longest period. So it has nothing to do with the eccentricity, it has to do with the big diameter. And so both of these guys had small eccentricities. Ah, so here we have to put lots of objects on the SCO one. So kind of the original, well, it's not very pretty, but well, I'll have to fix it a little bit. So this is the celestial equator. This is the ecliptic. This point where the ecliptic and the celestial equator intersect with the sun going from the south to the north, that's the vernal equinox. And then we're supposed to put lots of things on here. So the sun we can put on based on the date, and this is just a little bit after the fall equinox. So here's where the sun would be at the fall equinox, so here's where the sun is today. I remember that Venus was an evening star from that earlier question, so Venus should be close to the sun and on this side of the sun. And the moon was new yesterday, right? If I recall correctly from that earlier question. So that means the moon should also be pretty much the same place that Venus is as a evening star close to the sun. Mars and Jupiter. Question 36. So 36 says that Jupiter has a right ascension of 2 hours, 13 minutes. This has a right ascension of 0, so Jupiter should be on the ecliptic about there. Mars is going to be in opposition in the future. And if you remember this diagram, Mars has to be a morning star, so it has to be on the other side of the sun with a relatively big angle, not real super close to it, maybe 90 degrees away. So we want to go this way, but we've kind of run out of spots. So I don't know, something like that. Right, so again, an important factoid is this is the evening stuff, the evening star stuff, and this is the morning star stuff, to the right or left of the sun. And of course, this map wraps around so that a spot like there would be a morning star. And if you forget that morning star, evening star stuff, you can just think about what would happen if you just held up that map. And if you take that map and put the sun at the western horizon, then this stuff would be below the horizon and this stuff would be above the horizon. Exam 129. Cause of the seasons. So the things that you don't want to say is that the cause of the seasons has something to do with the distance between the sun and the earth changing, right? Doesn't work that way. In fact, the sun is closer to the earth in our winter than it is during our summer. So it has to do with the angle that the sun is above the horizon and how long the sun is above the horizon. So we know that in the summer, in our summer, when the sun is up here, it's going to have a higher angle above the horizon. Right? So for example, on June 21, we know that the angle between the sun and the equator is 23.5 degrees, and we know that our equator is 45 degrees above the southern horizon, so it's going to be 45 plus 68 degrees above the southern horizon, so pretty high in the sky. And therefore, the sunlight is going to be concentrated on a smaller area. There are these words, direct and indirect. If you already know what they mean, I guess that's good. I worry about them because, as far as I can see, there's no connection between that meaning of direct and any other meaning of direct. It just means whether the sun beams are hitting square to the surface of the planet or whether they're coming in at an angle. Usually direct would mean, indirect kind of sounds like a bounce or something like that. Nothing like that going on. So in any case, in the summer, the sun is high in the sky. It's above the horizon for more than 12 hours a day, so it's going to be doing a lot of heating. In the winter, the sun is going to be low on the horizon, right? 23.5 degrees subtracted from 45. It's going to be relatively low, so-called indirect sunlight. It's not going to be above the horizon for 12 hours a day, so we're going to have less heating. Another word that I don't like to hear is wobble. It's a word I was taught that the Earth's axis is wobbling, sometimes pointing away from the sun and sometimes pointing towards the sun. Well, yeah, sometimes it is pointing towards the sun and sometimes away from the sun. That part of it is true, but it's not changing direction, right? The North Pole, in our lifetime, is always going to be pointing at the star Polaris. So it's the orbital motion that changes whether the North Pole is pointed at the sun or away from the sun. Okay. Say again?
Number 38,
exam 2. Ah, so this is a big spectra problem. So I give you a spectra that looks, it's got kind of a bell-shaped curve. It's got something that goes up here. It's got something that goes down there. And it's got something that goes down there. And the first thing we're supposed to do is label the axes. And the things here are in nanometers, so this has to be wavelength. And the y-axis is always the amount of light. So blue light has a short wavelength, red light has a long wavelength. I'm not sure I care whether you know exactly what those numbers are, but something like 400 or so for the blue light, and something like 700 for the red light. But in any case, the blue should be shown as a shorter wavelength than the red light is. Absorption line. So that's where we're getting less light from the sun than we expect. The amount of light is low. Either of those two would be perfectly good absorption lines. Emission line, that's where we're getting extra light. The amount of light is more than we expect. This is the only example of an emission line on this drawing. Draw a set of energy levels and jumps that could produce the absorption and emission lines you labeled. Well, okay, so we need to particularly pick one. So let's let this one be the absorption line. This one has to be the emission line. This has a really long wavelength, a wavelength that is about twice as big as the emission line. Big wavelengths mean less energy. So this absorption line has to correspond to a jump that is half as big as the jump that's making that emission line. So absorption line is electrons jumping up. And here we have a bigger jump that's making a shorter wavelength for this emission line that's going down. Peak wavelength, this is the peak, right? Even if that was high, that still wouldn't be called the peak. And the peak is about at 600 nanometers or so. Sketch how the graph would change if it were cooler. So cooler means less light at every wavelength, and the peak is going to shift to longer wavelength, and the lines aren't going to change their position. So first of all, let's change where the peak is located, and let's make sure that we draw every place below this one. So maybe something like that. And then let's put the emission and the absorption lines at exactly the same spot as they were before. Sketch how the graph would change if the quantum leap producing your labeled emission lines, the initial energy was slightly higher. So if the energy was higher, then the jump is higher, which means that this line is going to be shifted to shorter wavelengths. Bigger jumps, shorter wavelengths. Sketch how the graph would change if the electrons making your making this absorption line happen less frequently. So if there's fewer jumps, there's going to be less light absorbed. So that means we'll get more light through, so the amount of light will be higher than it would have been otherwise. So just kind of thinking about, I think it's probably exam three sort of things where we had similar sorts of questions. So if the source of light is moving towards us, then everything would be shifted to the blue end. Everything would be shifted to the left in this case. If a star is spinning rapidly, then all of these lines get smeared out. So instead of being these little jagged peaks, they would end up getting smeared out, rounded. Kind of the same amount of missing light, but spread out over different wavelengths. Fewer atoms, that's going to do the same thing as having less absorption. And the difference between a main sequence star and a supergiant star. So supergiant stars have low atmospheric pressure, and so the lines aren't as perturbed as much, they're narrower. So in main sequence star, an absorption line might be relatively broad compared to the same line in a supergiant star, it would be relatively narrow. Exam 2, number 35. So, many of us looked at this at the observatory. Albireo, which is the Northern Cross, looks like a cross. This is Deneb. This is Albireo down here. And if you look at it with a telescope, you see a kind of a bluish star and a yellowish star. And what I say is that the blue star has magnitude 5, which means it's dimmer than the yellowish star. So we're supposed to explain lots of things. So the brighter one is the smaller magnitude, so that's the yellow star. Which star has the higher surface temperature? Well, you know that blue is hotter than yellow, so that's going to be the blue star. Which star must have the larger radius? That's usually where the problem occurs. Remember with those light bulbs, when you change the temperature, you hugely change the amount of light they're producing. So if they had the same area, the blue star would have to be producing way more light than the yellow star. So the only way the yellow star could be producing more light than the blue star is if it had hugely more area. So the yellow star has to have a larger radius than the blue star. Exam 326. So here we're plotting the future of the sun on this core condition. So we also have been plotting the sun on the HR diagram, and of course they're totally unrelated. What's going on the surface really has little to do with what's going on in the core. So this diagram I gave you is a plot of the density versus the temperature. And it's got lines on it that show where hydrogen will burn and where helium will burn and where carbon will burn. And it has a line on it that shows the difference between degenerate gas and normal gas. And of course, the main thing about the normal gas is the virial theorem will be active, and if it's not being powered, it's going to get hotter and denser as long as it's to the left of that line. The only way a star can cool off is it's to the right of the degenerate line. Okay, so the star obviously doesn't start at these, you know, million degree temperatures. It starts as a cool, extended, dense object. And currently it's not being powered by anything. There are no nuclear reactions going on in the core because we haven't reached the temperatures and densities that are required to burn hydrogen. So as the star contracts, it's losing energy and it heats up, and it reaches the main sequence. So this is where the sun is going to spend 10 billion years quietly burning hydrogen to helium in its core. When it runs out of hydrogen in its core, it's going to be losing energy. And it turns out that what happens is that it crosses this degeneracy line and it reaches the conditions to burn helium to carbon when it's degenerate. So now we don't have the virial theorem auto control going, so we're going to have an explosion. So this is the helium flash. This, incidentally, was the red giant phase. And in a small fraction of time, a good fraction of the helium is going to be burned. So this was usually denoted as a dotted line, but what's going to happen is the temperature of the core is going to increase, and the core is going to expand, so it can reach the non-degenerate state where we can stably burn helium to carbon. So here it'll sit for on the order of a billion years, where it's happily burning helium to carbon in its core. There's an outer shell of hydrogen burning to helium, but it's going to run out of helium fuel too. So if it's not powered, virial theorem says it gets hotter and denser, it's going to cross the degenerate line, and then it can cool off. So it never gets hot enough to burn carbon to oxygen and magnesium and neon. Neon, I guess, more than anything else. Okay. It might be worth also reminding you about the same sort of story about the HR diagram. Right, so HR diagram is, you know, different, right? So instead of temperature being on the y-axis, it's on the x-axis. And it's not the temperature of the core we're talking about, it's the temperature of the surface. And it's not going in a rational direction, it's going backwards. Right? So this is going to be the high temperatures, and these are going to be the low temperatures. And this is surface temperature, and this is luminosity. And here's kind of the main sequence. So here, where the sun was heating up, not burning anything, that's the protostar stage, where the star surface of the star is at on the order of 3,000 degrees. Here we're on the main sequence. When we run out of fuel in the center, we go to a red giant phase, and then we have the helium flash. Here's where the star is happily burning helium to carbon. We have a rise as we go to this double shell burning phase, and then we have thermal oscillations which puff off the outer layers of the star. So here we have the planetary nebula phase, where we have the remaining atmosphere of the star being illuminated with ultraviolet light from the extremely hot core of the star, which just cools off as a white dwarf. Right, so this was protostar, this was main sequence, red giant, this was helium flash, so this is usually called horizontal branch, this is asymptotic giant. And so it goes. So what's going on at the surface is really nothing like what's going on in the core.
I have a question. What does the horizontal branch mean?
So the horizontal branch is where it's quietly burning helium to carbon in its core, and there would be this outer shell of hydrogen burning to helium. It's maybe worth stressing that something that's maybe not so great about this diagram, this process here, going from the flash to the horizontal branch, that's a million-year process. Whereas this process here, that's a few-second process. And of course, the difference is the long time it takes for light to actually escape from inside of a star. So you can have big changes in the core, and they're not going to be reflected in what's happening on the surface for a long period of time. Exam 336. So this is one of these problems where we've got lots of data and we're supposed to interpret. And kind of the things that you want to keep in mind, of course, are, oh, be a fine girl, right? So that gives us temperatures. Right, so these are the hot stars and these are the cool stars. And the Roman numerals tell us the, technically speaking, the luminosity class. We have luminosity class 5, doesn't look like a 5 very much. Those are the main sequence stars. 3s are the giant stars and 1s are the supergiant stars. And we also have the distance modulus, which is the apparent magnitude minus the absolute magnitude. The bigger that number is, the further the star is away. Okay, so with that, with all those provisos, and of course we know that the magnitude of things is going to be bigger if it's smaller, if you follow what I mean, right? Magnitude 3 is brighter than magnitude 5. Okay, so which star is going to look brighter in the sky? We're going to look at the apparent magnitude. We're going to look for the smallest number. And negatives are smaller than positives, so Canopus. Which star is so dim that we can't see it with our naked eye? So dim is big numbers in apparent magnitude, and 13.5 is pretty dim. Can't see that. Can't see Wolf 359 even with binoculars, and be kind of hard-pressed to see it even actually with time exposures pictures. Highest surface temperature, we're looking for O stars, there aren't any. We got B stars, but we got 2B stars. And you might remember that the B0 stars are hotter than the B9 stars. So B3 is going to be hotter than B7. So that's number 8 lowest surface temperature, we're looking for M stars. And there are two M stars. The M8 is obviously, Wolf is obviously cooler than the M3 star. Largest radius. Well, supergiants should come to mind kind of immediately, but you might remember on the HR diagram that constant radiuses look kind of like this. So if we had, say, a bright giant class 2 M star, and we're comparing it to, say, a supergiant A star, it's kind of hard to tell which ones are going to be brightest. And I think that that was kind of the case here. We have an M3 bright giant, and we have an F not so bright, that is to say a 1B, and I would take either one of those as right answers. Smallest radius. So we're talking about main sequence stars, and you might remember that while main sequence stars roughly have the same radius, in fact, the hotter main sequence stars have a bigger radius than the cooler main sequence stars. So we've got a M and a B main sequence star, and so the smallest one is going to be the M main sequence star. Furthest away. So we're going to subtract the lowercase m from the uppercase m, and we're going to look for the biggest number. So like Canopus, we're going to have 4. But I think I can beat that with number 7 because I'm going to have 6.8, right? 3 minus a minus 3.8 is going to be 6.8. And I don't think anything is going to beat that. So 7. 10 parsecs away. Remember that the absolute magnitude is exactly the brightness that a star would have if it were at 10 parsecs. So if its absolute magnitude equals its apparent magnitude, then it must be at 10 parsecs. So number 4 is satisfying that. Giant stars, we got 2 luminosity class 3s. We've got a B and a K. B is going to be blue. K is going to be red. So we got Elnath number 5 as our blue-white giant star. Most similar to the Sun. Well, we got G zeros, but one of them is a main sequence star, and one of them is, you know, hugely different. It's a supergiant star. Oh, well, I guess we also have a G2 one, but it's also not going to be very similar to the Sun because it's a supergiant star. So main sequence and close in temperature to the Sun is number 4. Exam 224. Is this exam 2 or is this exam 1? What's waving? So with sound, it's a pressure wave, right? It's made out of condensations and expansions of the air. So air pressure is what's waving in sound waves. Or you could say density, because the air has been pushed together, it's going to be higher density. Or you could say temperature, because the compressions are going to have a higher temperature than the rarefactions. So usually pressure is the good answer, but also density and temperature are all going to be waving with sound waves. In the case of light, the peaks correspond to lots of electromagnetic stuff. Right, so big so light is an electromagnetic wave, and that's what's waving for light. Sound is typically described as a pressure wave. Yep, so if you go to our website, there's a link that's, I think it's listed, lectures.mp4 or something like that. If you click on that, then I think immediately what opens up is kind of the generic, a bunch of the perennial question sort of problems, like the culmination problem and the moon problem. there's a directory then that's listed as 212, and that's our directory. And if you go in there, then you'll see as MP4s all of the answers. And the files typically have names like this. Oops. Well, maybe it's the other way around. Yeah. So the A212T1, I hope, is clear, right? It's the first test for us. The R means that this is actually the Rth version of this exam that I've ever given. And the TF means that this is just the true and false part of it. So there'll be a thing that's called TF, there'll be a thing that's called short, and there'll be a thing that's called long. And those will be screencasts for three screencasts for each of the three exams that we've done. Same thing applies to the old exams. If you look in that same directory, there'll be a folder that's called 2010, and there'll be similar sorts of files for the old exams online.
So should we be looking at are the exam actually took for exam one and then the other two exam ones that we studied from? Should we be looking at all three or just the one that we actually took?
Well, so without a doubt, the first thing to look at is your old exams. And I guess I would say the second thing to look at is probably the stuff since the last exam. And then probably what I would look at is the old exams. So, you know, it's all good stuff, right? If it was on an old exam, it might be on your exam. But certainly, I think I've told you, I start this process by taking your old exams and putting them in a word processor and then trying to find questions to delete. So very similar sorts of stuff will be on your final, but not identical, just similar.
So that means all questions are from the old exams?
So not all questions are from the old exams, but many of the questions will be from your old exams.
Like what percentage?
Say again?
Like what percentage?
I don't know. I've never counted them up. So that's when we held the lens over a piece of paper and we got a focused image of these lights. And then the distance from the image to the lens was the focal length. So another way we had problems getting focal lengths of lenses was from the F number and the aperture. And that's not a good answer because lenses usually don't come with the F number listed on them. But you remember that the F number is the focal length divided by the diameter. So if you take the diameter and you multiply it by the F number, you will get the focal length. But that useful fact for some problems is not useful for a typical lens because they don't label lenses with the focal number. And on the other hand, it's just trivial, right? You just hold the lens over a piece of paper and it's an immediate measurement. Don't have to get out your calculators, even if it were stamped on it.
And you said we're going to have to know the Winter hex.
Yes. So you have to know, I mean, I will feel free to ask you questions about all of those sorts of things. So on, I forget which exam, I think there was a question like, Regulus was born before the sun. And kind of in order to answer that question, you needed to know the spectral type of Regulus. But the big 10-point question will be the Winter hexagon, where I'll ask you for names and spectral types and constellations.
Exam 2.
So what's a conservation law? So a conservation law is that some quantity is conserved, is held constant. So we talked about lots of conservation laws. The So I'm supposed to give two conservation laws an example where each applies. So the ones that we mostly talked about were energy, momentum, and angular momentum. So for angular momentum, the ice skater effect should come to mind, right? So that as we reduce the size of an object, it'll end up spinning faster. Momentum, the kind of typical example is shooting a gun on ice. The bullet goes one way, you go the other way. And conservation of energy, there are lots of ways of phrasing it, that energy isn't created or destroyed, so that the energy that is stored in the chemical bonds of coal, for example, is converted into thermal energy inside the boiler, which is converted to electrical energy that runs to our wires and where it does other sorts of useful work.
Number 20 on exam 3.
Stellar, 20? Is that what you said? Oh, 23. Clouds. So molecular clouds, H2 regions, H1 clouds, hot vacuum. Describe the atomic scale process that produces the light. How could the telescope be observed? So giant molecular clouds, those are the coolest clouds, and they're the ones that are detected. It turns out that hydrogen molecules under those circumstances are not big producers of light. So the rotation of an asymmetric molecule like carbon monoxide is typically how you observe molecular clouds. H2 regions, those are regions where we have a hot star that's exciting the gas that surrounds it. And while most of the gas is ionized, occasionally an electron will be picked up by one of those nuclei, and as it jumps down, every jump down is going to be producing a photon of light. So this is called recombination light. Typically it's optical light. H1 clouds, that's atomic hydrogen. That's spin flip light. Remember that the electron has a spin, the proton has a spin, they act like little magnets, and there's a little bit more energy in one orientation than the other orientation. So it produces, when the electron flips to its lower energy state, a photon with a wavelength of about 21 centimeters is emitted, so that's radio light. Hot vacuum, very high temperatures, Bremsstrahlung producing X-ray light. Same exam?
Yeah.
So exam 3, 24. How does a white dwarf differ from a brown dwarf? So a brown dwarf is a failed star. It's made of degenerate hydrogen gas, but it never got hot enough to burn hydrogen to helium. Whereas the white dwarf is the core of a star that has gone through all of its stages, so it has certainly burned all of its hydrogen to helium, and it may have burned most of its helium into carbon and oxygen. So dead star versus aborted star. More questions. Well, typically be in my office at normal sorts of hours, so you can stop by. You can try and email me or phone me if you've got other questions. So I think I told you we're looking at like 35 true false, I think 25 short answers, and like 7 or 8 longer answered questions. Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure that it's 25 short answers. So the 7 or 8 longer questions, that obviously means that it's kind of 1 or 2 from each exam. So the cuts are hard. Sure.
Are all of these questions that?
Pretty much. So some of the phraseology is different.
So I was looking at my notes, I couldn't find anything for this one.
Which one is that?
The radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yep. Radio galaxy.
What do you know what it's
called? So first of all, let me tell you one that I know we never use these words on, and that's number 13. We never talked about the hadron, lepton, and radiation eras. But we did talk about what the universe was like at various times. Those are just names that some people have given to those. Well, maybe I don't have my pictures anymore. I don't think I do. So for radio galaxies, we have the double lobes.